From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Last November, the New York Times Magazine made an ominous declaration. The insect apocalypse is here. Insects are disappearing, they said, and that could have implications for all life on Earth. A few months later, The Atlantic took a stab at the story, but their headline ended up with a question mark at the end. Is the insect apocalypse really upon us? And then Gizmodo weighed in with this winner of a headline, Bug Scientists Squash Insect Apocalypse Paper. In short, there's been a lot of media attention focused on bugs lately, and there seems to be a lot of debate about their status. That's where my next guests come in. David Wagner is an entomologist and a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at University of Connecticut. Eliza Grahams is a PhD candidate there, and they're part of a newly launched EntoGem project, an effort to map what we do and don't know about the status of insects. Welcome to the show to both of you.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
This work is, as I understand it, a direct response to the New York Times Magazine piece and other media coverage about the possibility of an insect apocalypse. Where did that idea and all of this concern get its start?
So the project got its start actually from a tweet by one of our collaborators, Neil Hadaway, who was asking about the methods used in a different paper recently that reviewed the status of insects. And we started talking about how there was all of this media coverage and people are really excited about insect declines right now, but we don't really know the current state of knowledge on them, and that we should use systematic mapping techniques and evidence synthesis to figure out what we do and don't know.
So let's talk a little bit about the research that has been put out there so far and that has fed some of this media coverage. I mean, one study earlier this year was a review of the existing research and concluded that insects as a whole will go down the path of extinction in a few decades, led to headlines that we could see the end of insects this century, but then others pointing out, well, yeah, but they only looked for studies with the word decline in them. If there were studies showing insects in some places or certain types of insects on the rise, they wouldn't have even found that. So how controversial and how perhaps surprising is this idea that insects widely as a whole might be in decline?
Well, I think there's pretty good evidence, just based on first principles, that insects are declining. Much of the planetary surface at this point is being deforested, much of it turned into agriculture. So we know that all biodiversity, plants, mammals, birds, and insects are in decline. And we have to make space for biodiversity and the life that we love and the ecosystem processes that they provide. We can't keep going down the route we're doing without thinking about all these ecosystem services that insects provide. So the big question, and Eliza already pointed this out, is we don't know sort of the magnitude. We don't know the rate. We don't exactly know where insects are declining and what lineages. So there's a lot of questions left. But we do know they are in decline. And we probably know enough now that we can act and start making some important conservation decisions.
Why is it so hard to know where and how dramatically insects are declining or what kinds of insects are declining?
Well, part of it is just their sheer diversity. Over half the organisms on the planet that we can see with our eyes when we go out in the woods or a field are insects. And so we're talking about millions of species, and it's hard pegging data to those individual lineages or taxa or species. But there's this other problem that insects, by and large, are boom and bust species. They have good years and bad years. We all know this. In New England right now, we're having gypsy moth trouble again, right? So, but 3 years from now, there won't be so many gypsy moths because the natural enemies are going to catch up with them. But we can go out and we can measure how many grizzly bears we have or how many cardinals that are out there, and that's probably going to be more or less constant from year to year, and we'll see steady declines or increases, what have you. With insects, you could collect that census data 10 years in a row and not really know if they were increasing or declining. And what we're seeing from the good studies is that we have declines of 1 or 2% per year, and that's a very small amount to see and measure, but it has catastrophic consequences in the sense that if we lost 10% for a decade, and that happened two or three decades in a row, we're losing pollination services. You know, we're jeopardizing food security. This is a big deal.
Well, Eliza Grames, your graduate research at University of Connecticut is focusing on ways to improve how we take the data that we do have and synthesize that into a broader picture. And in particular, for the Entegem project, you're trying to use a technique called data maps. What does that mean?
So systematic mapping is a technique to find all of the studies, published and unpublished, on a topic and then describe them by their characteristics, which we can use to identify knowledge clusters and knowledge gaps. So knowledge clusters would be things that have been studied a lot, either taxonomically or regionally. And then the gaps are areas where we need new primary studies because we're lacking data. And so we're using that to identify all of these studies out there on insect populations and biodiversity trends so that we can get a sense of where we need to prioritize research.
How is that better than the technique that has traditionally been used, and that we were just talking about one study like this, where researchers go and just do a search, a keyword search through a database of published studies and synthesize what they then get back and read on their own?
So it avoids a lot of the biases that can come in there. If a single group of researchers is doing a review and doesn't have an established protocol in advance laying out how they're going to find studies, they can end up kind of, you know, finding one subset of studies that are all on a similar topic or introducing bias based on articles that they're already familiar with. And so it's not a transparent process where anybody can look at it from the outside and figure out what has gone wrong. And so you're not really getting the complete picture with a traditional review that you would get from evidence synthesis techniques like systematic mapping.
So with your project now, the Entegem project, you're looking to start later this summer in August the process of screening articles or studies to be included in your data map. Who can participate in this?
Anybody who is concerned about insect populations globally, so that includes, you know, professional entomologists, conservation biologists, grad students, anyone even from like nature centers, people who organize bioblitzes, or just insect enthusiasts who want to participate in the project. We've got it set up so that whenever we're finding and screening articles, multiple people will make decisions on the same article, so that we can be pretty confident that we've made the correct decision about whether or not an article meets the criteria to be included in the map. So anybody can participate as long as they are concerned about insects.
That means anybody could go out and find an article and say, hey, I think this should be part of it, and send that to you. But also anybody could get a little bit of training from you guys and go through and screen what's already been submitted and say, yes, this should be included. No, it shouldn't. I mean, those are the kinds of decisions that you're crowdsourcing, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. So we have people have actually already submitted articles to us that they think merit consideration to be included in the map. And then we are working with cisrev.com, which is an open access platform for screening. So people can sign up. They can get training on systematic mapping techniques and get involved that way.
This obviously is not a quick turnaround project, but how long do you think it will be, Eliza Grames, until you have some sort of answer about what we do and don't know and what the existing body of research does say about the status of insects?
We've got the protocol posted online right now already, and we've been soliciting public comments on it. And so we're hoping then, like you said, to get screening going in August, and that should take a month or two. And so we should hopefully have a pretty solid data set of what studies exist by the end of the year. And then we can move forward from there to look at the knowledge clusters and do more in-depth syntheses, like we can do meta-analyses on topics where there's enough studies out there to get a better picture of what's going on with insects.
David Wagner, as an entomologist and an ecologist, you've already said that insects probably are widely on the decline. That could have widespread implications, including things like pollination of food crops. As the scientific community, the Entegem project and others presumably also trying to get a handle on what we do and don't know and what the status of insects are, as that process works its way through, what should we be doing in the meantime? You've already said you think that we have enough information to start making some conservation choices. What might those be?
Well, a big finding of the recent reviews is that we're finding declines even inside our parks and preserves. This is particularly true in Europe. And I think we have to sort of rethink how we treat lands. Humans are already converting maybe 60% of the land area of the planet for silviculture and agriculture. other intensive grazing and intensive land uses. And what we need to do is maybe make those processes more nature-friendly and do a better job of protecting biodiversity, not just in our parks and our preserves. The decisions we make about planting gardens in our yard, whether to plant natives versus ornamentals that don't support any caterpillar life, and if they don't support any caterpillar life, they don't support any bird life. We might as well be putting up signs in our front yard, "Birds not welcome here," when we plant our yards with ornamentals. So there's all kinds of projects at a local level, and then even at the industrial agricultural level, that where we could change our practices and do things in a more nature-friendly way. So these are the kinds of things we have to do. We have to start making some policy decisions. We have to open up some funding streams so we can monitor insects and also figure out how to do things in a better way, maybe promote organic farming to a greater extent. And another thing that's very, very important for insects and for all of the wildlife that we love and wildflowers, we have to stop putting carbon into the atmosphere and scale back and figure out where our energy sources are going to be without putting carbon into the atmosphere. These are the kinds of things that we can start acting on now.
That is David Wagner. He is an entomologist and a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at University of Connecticut. Eliza Grames is a PhD candidate at the University of Connecticut, and they are part of a newly launched EntoGem project to map what we do and don't know about the decline of insects. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us, Heather.
It's been a pleasure.
Up next, researchers want to make better prosthetic legs. Volunteers are tripping over and over again to help them. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Imagine being tripped over and over again, knowing that it would keep happening, but never knowing when. Sounds like a nightmare, right? Well, it's exactly what some people have volunteered to do in order to help make prosthetic legs better. Shane King is a graduate student at Vanderbilt University. He designed the system that did the tripping, and he's lead author of a new paper documenting the results of the experiment. Shane, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just make sure we're on the same page to begin with. I mean, prosthetic legs have developed amazingly in recent years. Where are we on the scale between like peg leg and thought controlled? Presumably somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, I'd say at this point we're definitely not at thought control by any means, but we're at a very good point compared to peg leg. So at this point, if someone's wearing pants that covers their leg, a lot of times people won't even notice that someone's using a prosthesis if it's well-tuned and well-fitted to their height. It looks like normal motion as long as it's not anything too arduous. So if you're just walking over level ground in the office or on a sidewalk, it's hard to even say that you could recognize it if you can't actually see the device itself.
And is that the result entirely of mechanical refinements, or is there software involved in that?
So it's a bit of both. There are plenty of legs out there right now, prosthetic devices, that are purely mechanical, and they work very well. They're not as robust in safety to a point, and then also that sort of looking like a normal human gait, able-bodied gait. Those are typically the microcontroller prostheses. So those do use software so they can change the damping. So there's like a viscous fluid in there that they use that they can make more or less viscous.
Hmm.
So it can change the rate of swing of the leg. So it can you can walk with different cadence and you can really fine tune the motion of the leg that way.
And yet handling the possibility of being tripped, handling obstacles that might stumble someone is still a challenge for these legs, right?
Definitely, definitely. So the obvious one that affects all legs, no matter what, is that people who use these devices don't get that same feeling that someone who has both legs gets when they hit an obstacle. You feel it right away. You get this reflexive response. At best, with a prosthesis, you feel the vibrations up through your residual limbs. So it's a slow response if you even notice at all. What ends up happening a lot of times is people start to hop on their unaffected leg until they can get back into their rhythm and bring their prosthesis back out in front of them again, and they can start to land on it. And even then, once you start to land on it, it's a slow transition back to walking. A lot of times they have to stop and recover and readjust.
Hmm. Well, Shane King, I wonder in deciding to try to work on this challenge of making prosthetic legs that would better be able to handle the challenges of encountering an obstacle and not tripping, ideally, not falling, at what point did you realize that in order to do this, we're going to have to actually trip people over and over and over to understand the problem?
So we knew that pretty much right from the get-go. We didn't know exactly how we were going to do it, and that was sort of what the first year or so of my graduate school and my co-contributor Mara Eveld's graduate school program was just developing this device so that we could actually have a test bed for what we were hoping to design with the actual robotic leg itself.
So describe this system, because it's not by any means simple. You've got so many different things wrapped into this complete system in order to be able to have volunteers who have to be repeatedly tripped without knowing that it's coming and yet kept safe enough that they don't actually fall and hurt themselves.
Right. So there's like the physical apparatus that we created, which is essentially a ramp with a big steel block on it. So it's just like a sort of, we call it a roller coaster because it's these two acrylic tracks and this 35-pound solid steel block has four bearings that kind of look like, or four sets of bearings. It's like a stack, but they kind of look like roller coaster wheels that lock into this channel. And we have an electromagnet, and when we release that electromagnet, this block slides down the ramp so smoothly that you can't even feel the vibrations, because that was a major issue in previous studies as well as in our initial like pilot designing.
Because the person would then know it was coming.
Exactly. So if there was any vibration at all, people would at the very least kind of get this like, is that? And then they would like stiffen up. Or if it was enough,
right.
We had some early testing where people would just step right over it. As soon as they felt it, they would step right over it. And so
it's amazing that we respond that intuitively and that quickly to any possible idea that there might be an obstacle in our way.
Right. And it doesn't hurt that people were, especially initially before we figured out how to keep people's minds off the task, people were a little stressed. Certain subjects, at least, were a little stressed and high anxiety about it.
That
walking
sounds
a little.
Like an understatement to me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was definitely some that didn't have a lot of fun doing it. A lot of high knees walking and like really lifting your toes up a lot as you walked. And so we had to come up with some pretty fun ways to get people to sort of calm down and not think about it.
So how did you do that?
So obviously couldn't have the subjects looking at the block. So for that, we used dribble goggles. So like what they train children to dribble basketballs with, where they just block your lower field of view. The final sort of piece that we have there is we make the subjects do serial sevens, which is essentially just we give them a random large number and they count backwards by sevens. So super grueling. It's always everyone's least favorite part. And it keeps them really preoccupied, though.
Yeah. I'm not sure I could count backward by sevens and walk at the same time. It's definitely harder than walking and chewing gum.
Oh, yeah. It's tough. People are always really self-conscious, and they're like, oh, you're not gonna make sure I'm correct, are you? And I'm like, oh, no, don't worry. We're just going to make sure you're not counting by like ones or twos.
Well, and then the final piece in this is that everybody who's doing this is actually wearing a safety harness, but it's a dual purpose. It's a safety harness, but it's also how you measure whether or not the person would have fallen, right?
Right. So there's that component. Then additionally, even before the harness is needed, there's also our sort of the computer side of the whole thing. So we've got this block and this ramp and the magnet, right? But then there's actually this whole computer algorithm that is being run in the background that figures out exactly when we need to release the giant block so that we can very specifically target percentages of your swing phase when your foot's off the ground. But yes, so from there, we do have a full body harness on them for safety because there's no handrails because we don't want them grabbing handrails because that would totally change. You don't have handrails in real life when you're walking on the sidewalk and trip on the curb. So we had to get rid of those. And from there, we still need to make sure that if they fell, they didn't actually fall and land on the treadmill and slide off the back or anything like that. So we gave them this full body harness and attached it to a load cell. And so the load cell actually measures the force that's being applied or that the rope is providing. So like the assistance, how much of their body weight is being held up through that harness. And while that wasn't really an integral part of the study for the healthy subject study that we just published on, since only one subject fell one time in that study, that's going to play a lot larger role in our future studies where we are working with our devices and with subjects with amputation.
So you managed to line up subjects to actually volunteer to be tripped over and over and over, close to 200 times, never know it was coming, being tripped at all these different points in their walking gait so that you can figure out what tripping looks like, the mechanics of it, maybe how we handle it. And I understand you actually yourself volunteered to in the development. You had this done to yourself. And I can imagine this could go two ways. It could be incredibly stressful, bordering on traumatic, or it could be kind of hysterically funny that you're just constantly tripping.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like to actually do this?
It definitely went both ways at times. It was, especially in the beginning, it was a little more of that traumatic nature where it was when it was the first time is always really big. So you're really worried about it. I remember I definitely put it off. I think I was the last of our three initial pilot testers to go. And for us pilot testers, it was definitely a few hundred times each. I think one of our lab mates one day, I think we stumbled him like 70 times in one day.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's definitely these large amounts of tripping and stumbling ourselves that was going on. So by the end, it became a lot more rhythmic almost. You were quite – like it wasn't that you were responding different because it's still a reflexive response, but that anxiety goes away. So you're not worried about it. You're not as stressed about it. If anything, you get a little more relaxed and a little bit more like you probably normally would be when you trip. But it definitely gets funny going back and watching the videos of ourselves doing it. And then we tried it with an adapter so that we could test it out on a prosthesis. And that was definitely a bit more traumatic. We actually put a heart rate monitor on me when we did it, and I was so nervous that the first time it happened when I fell, I think my heart rate reached like 180 beats per minute or something insane. And it felt like, in my mind, it felt like learning to fall as an adult if you never learned to fall as a kid. That is kind of what it felt like, where it was just like you knew you were going to fall, but you didn't know how to handle it. And it was definitely a little more anxiety-inducing than just regular walking with both legs and stumbling.
And potentially a really valuable insight into the experience of those who have to wear a prosthetic limb.
Definitely.
Right. You were doing it as a volunteer and it was temporary, but obviously you're doing this to help people for whom this is daily life and a daily challenge.
Exactly. And what we want to do is we want to get everything working as well as we possibly can before we start to bring participants in to actually wear our devices and to test out the system with their device, their daily use device. So we want to make sure that we're not wasting their time.
Well, so Shane King, what you're alluding to here is if you're going to carry this through to the point of designing better prosthetic limbs and testing whether those new designs actually do work and handle tripping scenarios better, eventually you're going to have to bring in individuals wearing their current prosthetics and then wearing your newly designed prosthetics and go through this same tripping process. But there's a lot to do between now and then. I mean, what have you learned from this initial study watching and measuring the trip responses of able-bodied individuals?
Yeah, so you're exactly correct. There's a good bit to go before we get to the sort of final product or the end goal. With the biomechanics, we're taking all this data and we're going through it and we're trying to figure out the why of how people respond, because there's actually a lot of different ways. And we're trying to figure out what the body uses to determine which strategy it uses to recover. Like what factors and what variables do a good job describing or classifying which strategy you're going to choose. So it might not be exactly like what the human body does, but it's these variables that we can look at and that can potentially be used in future prostheses to make the stumble recovery even better. But then on that other branch, what we're doing is we're still moving ahead with our original robotic prosthesis that Vanderbilt developed. We're going to try to find a way that we can best provide that support and structure to an individual with an amputation without making it more difficult for them. Because you could think of a situation where your leg does something, your prosthesis does something that you're not expecting that actually makes it even harder to recover and you're more likely to fall without trying to go too far overboard and make something that's either more dangerous or more problematic or something that the user doesn't trust.
Right. I mean, if the leg actually detects the obstacle before you do, because as you were saying, you can't necessarily feel it. You only get that indirect message that there's an obstacle there to respond to. Somehow, your body and your prosthesis need to respond to that in a coordinated way.
Right. Right. So that's a lot of what we're trying to work through right now, is figuring out what sort of what factors and what variables we can use to sort of more simply initially figure out a response so that the subject, the user, isn't surprised and that it still does a better job and makes it a lot less of a risky or dangerous activity. Because right now, currently, people with transfemoral amputation are 200 times more likely to fall than their age-match healthy equivalents. So it's a lot higher risk of falling, and then subsequently a lot higher risk of injuries that come out of falling. So our hope is that by meeting in the middle, we'll be able to reduce that by a significant amount.
Maybe a little bit of humor factor in tripping people over and over for research, but serious and important research. Shane King of Vanderbilt University, a graduate student who has developed a system that does trip people over and over, but in order to develop better prosthetic legs. Shane, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Jupiter's Great Red Spot. It's one of the most recognizable features of any planet in our solar system, right up there with Saturn's rings. And remarkably, it's a storm, a really huge storm that's been raging for hundreds of years. But it seems to be changing. Observers say it's shrinking, and they've seen wisps peeling off in recent months. So what does that mean? Amy Simons is a senior planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you just describe some of the changes in the red spot that have been seen in recent months?
Sure. So we've been monitoring the Great Red Spot actually for a number of years now using the Hubble Space Telescope. And one of the things we noted was, besides getting smaller, which we've observed for decades, it was actually getting much more intense in color, a very deep orange. And it turns out that at the same time it's been shrinking inward, it's actually getting taller. So it's extending higher up into the atmosphere, and we think it's being exposed to even more sunlight and ultraviolet radiation. So it's essentially getting a sunburn.
Wow. So it's actually not necessarily total volume getting smaller, but it sounds like it's kind of being squeezed, getting narrower and taller, like more of a column.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like the potter's wheel, where you have your spinning clay, and if you push on it, it'll get taller. Same sort of idea.
And then some amateur astronomers have also noticed perhaps wisps, something kind of spinning off of it.
Yeah, that's a little bit confusing. And so we're looking at that now. When you're talking about this, you're talking about essentially a storm. So you're not talking about a solid object. You're talking about wind and cloud. And what we see is that the winds that go around the Great Red Spot are kind of partially responsible for the way it spins, but they also interact with it. Clouds get pulled in and they get torn apart. Sometimes they pass along, but sometimes they make these wisps. And so the question is, when we see a new one, was it something from inside the spot itself or something from the outside that just didn't get pulled all the way in?
I mean, you say a spinning storm. Is this essentially like a hurricane? How big would this be if it were on Earth?
So it is quite a bit like a hurricane, except it's not a low-pressure storm like a hurricane. It's a high-pressure storm. So it's actually an anti-hurricane or an anti-cyclone. So that's really the only difference. It's spinning the opposite direction, and it's high pressure. And this one, it started out when we were really observing it in a lot of detail, say back when Voyager 1 or 2 flew by in the 70s, it was about three times the size of the Earth.
Wow.
And because it's been shrinking, it's now about just a little bit bigger than the Earth. But still, that concept of a storm, the size of the planet is, you know, it's mind-boggling.
A little bit mind-blowing, for sure. And it's a storm that's been going for hundreds of years, right?
Right. We've been tracking it back to see exactly when it formed, and we don't know. So we have records that go back into the 1800s, actually, and I've even used them in my research, which is a lot of fun. But it's been continuously tracked since the late 1800s. But there were reports actually in the late 1600s by Cassini and by other famous astronomers where they thought they saw a permanent spot on Jupiter.
The actual person Cassini, not the spacecraft Cassini.
Exactly the person. you know, very early telescopes, they were seeing what they thought was a permanent spot. But we can't prove it was the same one. It doesn't seem like it was the right size or location. It might have been a precursor could have been a completely different storm. We just don't know because there weren't any reports of it after the early 1700s. So there's that gap of 150 years in there. But that aside, we're still talking a storm that's lasted 150 years. And that's, you know, again, it's just crazy.
Well, Amy Simon, as a planetary scientist looking around our solar system and perhaps beyond, this idea of a storm that is larger than our planet is pretty mind-blowing. But how rare or unusual is it?
It's rare in the sense that we don't have any storms that last this long. We don't see storms like this on Saturn. We see them on Neptune. Now, the ones on Neptune can be just as big, but they don't last very long. And that's because of how the winds are set up on those planets are quite different. And so on Jupiter, the jet streams are very constant. They're always blowing the same speed in the same direction. And so they kind of confine these storms into channels, and that helps to keep them stable for so long.
And you said that you've been seeing changes in Jupiter's Great Red Spot for a decade or more in terms of changing size, the kind of wisps of stuff that we're not sure what they are. That's a more recent thing. But how surprising are any of these changes?
In some ways, they're not that surprising. When we make computer models of a storm, it's actually very hard to get them to last very long. And what we've seen is when something kind of coalesces and forms, it tends to get smaller and smaller until it breaks apart. So from that perspective, I think it's maybe not unusual. But I grew up seeing the Voyager pictures of Jupiter, you know, and as you said, the Great Red Spot's one of the most recognizable storms in the solar system. And so the idea that we can watch it changing in our lifetime is, you know, that's pretty incredible. That's teaching us a lot about how atmospheres work.
Does that mean that you think maybe we are seeing the end of Jupiter's Great Red Spot, that we could see that within our lifetime?
It's actually quite possible. The fact that it's gotten so much smaller, it's likely to do one of two things. It'll either stabilize where it is and stop shrinking, or if it continues to grow taller because it now encounters different high-level winds up at the top, it can actually get pulled apart, which is one of the ways hurricanes get broken apart on Earth. So, yeah, it's actually quite possible we could see that sort of change in our lifetime.
And as you mentioned, for those of us who grew up seeing images of this, and that's kind of our image of Jupiter, is that side of the planet with that big red spot there. It seems kind of bizarre and maybe even sad to think about that going away. But oftentimes when you talk to the people who study these things, what seems like an unfortunate event for the rest of us is actually a really exciting learning opportunity. And you already mentioned that you're already learning more about this storm. I mean, is this kind of an exciting thing for you?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, atmospheric scientists and even oceanographers, fluid dynamicists, always like to see things change because that's when we can actually test our models and test the equations. We know they're supposed to work, but if nothing is changing, it's hard to see that they're doing what we expect. So when you see a change like this, it kind of disturbs the whole region. It gives us a chance to really check those models out and check out those equations, make sure we understand everything that goes into them. So yeah, we're excited to watch it change.
And what do those models tell you about? Is it just about the atmosphere of Jupiter, or are there lessons that we could learn from the Great Red Spot that would teach us about hurricanes on Earth or storms elsewhere in the universe?
It's actually rather interesting if you look at the history of how we studied these things going way back before we had computers. Everything was on paper, and it was these incredibly complicated mathematical equations. And eventually we got to the point where we made computer models to try to model an atmosphere, model circulation. And the first of those, of course, was for the Earth. But again, computer power was quite limited. So certain things had to be hard-coded into the computer model just to make it run in a reasonable amount of time. And as we have more and more data, we find it gets harder and harder sometimes to predict climate and to predict circulation. And so having a case like Jupiter or any of the giant planets, they're sort of the same equations and different boundary conditions. We don't have land. We have different rotation rates. We're farther from the sun. So now we can put all those variables back in, and your physics should work the same on all the planets. So if we have our models correct on Earth, they should also work on Jupiter, on Mars, on any other planet. And so, yeah, having an event like this that, gee, if we can't get the model to match this and work, that's telling us we don't have all the details right in the model. And if we can fix those little things for Jupiter, we can also take them back the other direction, and that model should still work on Earth. So yeah, I think we can use these sorts of things and learn about all the planets at the same time.
Amy Simon is a senior planetary scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center studying Jupiter's Great Red Spot. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next, it turns out sea level is a lot like politics. It's all local, and weather may be a major factor. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Sea level is rising globally due to ocean warming and melting ice sheets. But the rate of sea level rise is not the same everywhere. Here in New England, we've had an above-average rate of sea level rise, but also a lot of variation in water levels along our coasts. And for several years, researchers have thought that might be tied to changes in the strength of the Gulf Stream. But new research suggests that it's not the Gulf Stream. It's, in fact, local weather that is driving those changes in our local sea level. And that could lead to local sea level forecasts. Joining me now is Chris Pikusch. He's at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here, Heather.
Let's kind of go back to the very beginning of this. Why would we potentially expect the Gulf Stream and this whole system of currents to slow down with climate change? I mean, that's an idea that's been around and been debated for a long time. What's at the root of that?
That's right. So the basic idea going back, as you say, a pretty long time is the idea that as climate change occurs into the future, as the climate gets warmer, the ocean's going to warm. The surface ocean will warm more. That warming of the surface ocean actually in principle is thought to prohibit these processes that happen at high northern latitudes, specifically the formation of deep, dense waters, which sustain what some people call the ocean conveyor belt or the overturning circulation. So the idea is that with global warming, that whole circuit of currents will slow down. And the Gulf Stream, it, of course, is one component of that larger overturning cell of circulation.
So the Gulf Stream then is kind of the top. You mentioned the conveyor belt. It's kind of the top belt on the conveyor belt.
That's right. So you have these currents near the ocean surface, which act collectively to bring warmer waters north. And at the same time, you have these currents that are well below the surface that are bringing colder waters south. So you have this circuit that's being completed.
And you said, so if the water up north gets too warm, then that conveyor belt kind of backs up, it slows down. Why would that then be thought to influence sea level along the East Coast?
Well, that's the great question. So again, our oceans are filled with these very powerful currents that are transporting vast amounts of water and heat around. So the idea is if you were to change or slow under a climate change scenario, change or slow these currents, the manner in which these currents are moving water and heat around would change. Okay, and the idea is that with these changes in how water is, if you will, directed in the ocean, that could lead to, if you want to say it a bit crudely, water piling up at our coast. But again, this has been more of a hypothesis, sort of a question we as a community have been interested in because we think that it is a possibility, but something we've been trying to learn more and more about.
Well, Chris Pikusch, that part of figuring out more about it and figuring out if these processes are actually happening has been the subject of a lot of effort and also a fair bit of debate. I mean, where does that stand? Are we seeing the Gulf Stream and this whole conveyor belt system slowing down?
Depends on who you ask. It's a really complicated question. And part of the problem here is that on the one hand, a lot of the behavior that we've been discussing is based on analyses of these climate models. So they're models that we run into the future under these hypothetical scenarios of so much global warming, say. But what we like to do as scientists is to take those models but corroborate them, test them against observations. And the real difficulty here is that we just don't have very long direct measurements of these major limbs of the ocean circulation, which makes it hard to test those model-based hypotheses.
Right. It's hard to know if the Gulf Stream is slowing down if we don't know what it was doing 30 or 50 or 100 years ago.
Exactly. So that, I mean, that's a big question in the community. And as you just say, we don't have long direct measurements that we really desire.
But we do have one recent event that got a lot of people's attention, and that was, I believe it was 2009.
That's right.
And for that year specifically, the Gulf Stream seemed to be a lot slower and sea level along the Northeast coast seemed to be a lot higher. What happened that year?
That's right. Yeah. So to put all this in context, as I said, we have lacked these long-term measurements in the community. But motivated by that, starting in about 2004, international scientists got together and developed this large network of sensors, which cover the whole Atlantic at a particular latitude, at 26 north. So this is spanning from about the southeast coast of Florida near Miami, going all the way across the Atlantic to the Moroccan coast.
Wow.
And this set of sensors has been continuously monitoring this overturning cell we've been talking about. And you're exactly right. About 5 years after those measurements started, there was this really surprising, very striking decline of about 30%, the whole overturning circulation. Yeah, exactly, right? It's a bit startling. People got pretty worried about it. And at the exact same time, based on coastal tidal gauge measurements, we saw sea level up and down the New England coast raise by, in some months, up to 6 inches.
Well, Chris Pikusch, some of your new work that you've just published is aimed at looking at that event and explaining what the relationship might be because, of course, okay, these two things happened at the same time. The question then is, did one of them cause the other? Did that dramatic slowdown in the current system cause the higher sea level? And it wasn't just tide gauges that saw it. I mean, people saw flooding. It was something we could see with our own eyes that year that water levels were higher. So how do you actually start to answer that question of whether one caused the other?
As one of my colleagues is fond of saying, sea level is a noisy place. We've been talking a lot about how changes in ocean currents may or may not affect sea level. But of course, ocean current changes aren't the only game in town. We've got, of course, tides and waves and storms, melting ice sheets, ocean warming, all kinds of things that are going on in our climate system now that all potentially contribute to changes in sea level at the coast. So you're right. So we see these simultaneous events, weakening of the circulation, a rise in coastal sea level. So how do we go about investigating, testing whether or not this really was a cause and effect, whether the decline in the ocean circulation actually caused sea level to rise? Well, this is where we bring in sort of the theories of physics and what we know as oceanographers about how the ocean behaves. One thing that's really important to understanding sea level change on our coast here in New England is what the local weather is doing. If you have changes in how the winds are blowing, whether you have high or low atmospheric pressure in a given month or season or year, those things are really, really important to driving sea level changes.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there for a second because that seems completely unintuitive, at least to me. I mean, I think of sea level as being this much larger process that the weather's just kind of sitting on top of that, and it might make waves. It might even make a storm surge, but it would change sea level?
Locally, at least. You're right. So you hit on an important distinction, which is we hear a lot in the news about global sea level rise. And in the context of global sea level rise, you hear about things like the melting of the Greenland or the Antarctic ice sheet. Similarly, you hear a lot about global ocean warming, because when you warm water, you're going to expand it. So those are things that are of concern when you're talking about the global average. But the global average, while it's informative for us scientists, it's not necessarily directly relevant to people living in a particular place on the coast, because sea level, again, the same colleague is sort of fond of saying all sea level is local. Okay, so this...
just like politics.
There
right?
It is, right? So the sea level change that we feel, say, here in Woods Hole is not necessarily going to reflect what's happening on the global average, because these things like winds and pressure act to not change the global average, but move around the water that's already present in the ocean, so that, for instance, you could have sea levels rising in one place at the same time that they fall elsewhere.
So jumping ahead, Chris Pikusch, what your most recent work is showing, not to steal your punchline here, is that, in fact, it was not the slowdown in the current system that caused the higher sea level along the Northeast coast in 2009, that, in fact, it was these local weather conditions affecting both.
That's
right.
So that this is the really interesting thing that we found in our recent research. Again, remember the context. We found correlation. The current weakened at the same time that sea level rose. But if we can think back to the winter of 2009, 2010, I certainly remember it because I was doing a lot of shoveling. It was a pretty severe winter that we had. And it turns out that these local weather conditions that we experienced along the Northeast coast, say a pretty harsh, snowy winter, we as New Englanders didn't feel those wacky conditions in isolation. It turned out that conditions were very unusual across the whole North Atlantic region, not only along the northeast coast of the U.S., but also in Europe and elsewhere. So in that particular winter, you had very large-scale changes in weather systems. So you have this current decline in the overturning circulation. You have a rise in sea level over our region of the coast, but there were also unusual sea level changes in places like the Mediterranean Sea, along the North Sea, even places far north like Hudson Bay, all these very unusual behaviors all happening at the same time. Okay, and these are, again, all related to large-scale variations in the basic weather patterns.
How can you be sure of that, though? I mean, it's not like you're running an experiment in the lab and say, okay, if I change the current, then the weather changes and the sea level rise changes, or if I change the weather, the currents change. I mean, how can you actually be sure what's the cause and what's the effect?
That's right. That's a great question. So we as earth scientists, as oceanographers, are a little bit at a disadvantage. I mean, when people think of science and hypothesis testing, they think of exactly what you described. You're in a lab, you perform several experiments, you have some control parameters and all of this, so you're able to tease out causation. We've only got one Earth, and we can't really run experiments on it. But what we can do is run simulated experiments. We can run virtual experiments based on the laws of physics. This is where models come in. So in our study, when we tried to understand whether or not this change in the overturning circulation, remember this 30% drop in 2009, 2010, whether that was actually the cause of the sea level rise we saw at the same time, we actually ran some model experiments. And through those model experiments, we said, okay, we know we had a pretty harsh winter in 2009, 2010. The winds behaved in such a way. The atmospheric pressure behaved in such a way. Based on our understanding of physics, what effect should that have had on sea levels at the coast? And sure enough, when you ask the model equations, how does sea level behave when you apply a wind like this or a pressure like this? Turns out that you get that sea level rise. So this is making no reference to what happened to ocean currents over the open Atlantic. This is saying just meteorology locally along the New England coast, that was able to explain the sea level rise during that particular winter.
Well, Chris Pikusch, this is interesting at an academic level to understand how all these processes interact with each other. But when the rubber hits the road, what planners and, for that matter, homeowners really need to know is how high is the water going to get? And we've typically had these very long-range predictions of, you know, as you were saying, global average or maybe even kind of a regionally adjusted average that we might see 1 or 3 or 6 feet of sea level rise by a certain, you know, number of decades in advance. How does understanding how these really local weather processes affect sea level from year to year impact efforts to plan for sea level rise?
That's a great question. So the way that our research fits into the broader picture is that it emphasizes that we've got to consider everything collectively. As you said, there is a considerable effort in the scientific community to understand things like future ocean warming, melting of the Antarctic ice sheet, to project these long range, say 100, you know, 50, 100 year down the road sea levels. And that's really, really important. If we predict that sea level will rise so fast into the future due to melting ice sheets and ocean warming, how helpful is that long-term prediction for me having a sense maybe next year or 5 years from now of guessing how high the sea levels will be? Even if we're having a long-term rise, maybe we have a really, really bad winter and the seas on top of that long-term rise are 6 inches higher than we thought they would have been.
Right. A bad situation gets even worse.
There it is. Or on the other hand, you could have a mild winter, you know, where the winds and the pressure are favorable such that even though you have this long-term rise, at least for this short season, the conditions were partly ameliorated by the conditions locally being somewhat more favorable. So it adds a range on top of that long-term prediction. And the real challenge of the community is really bringing together everything. As I said before, sea level is really complicated because there's so many things that are going on in our climate system that cause changes. All this adds together to give you, you know, what sea level conditions we're feeling here at Woods Hole or any other locality along the coast. So you really have to have a comprehensive picture of all of these processes so that we can inform not only 100 years into the future, but also next season or next year.
I mean, it sounds like you could use this information to essentially create sea level forecasts in the same way that we have weather forecasts or even seasonal outlooks.
That's exactly. And that really is one of the outstanding goals of the oceanography and the sea level community, having these predictions or these projections that are not only 50 or 100 years out, but, you know, next month, next year.
That's Chris Pikusch of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Chris, thanks.
My pleasure.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.